Shabbat shalom and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning Bible study. It's good to be here with you this morning. Most of our local congregation are away for the holidays, and so we hope that they're enjoying some good family fun and some great food over the holidays. I know many of you have as well. I hope that all of you, at least our American viewers, had a wonderful Thanksgiving, and the rest of you need to come up with a cool Thanksgiving holiday. It's one of my favorite times of year, even though it's not a biblical festival. In many ways, I tend to make it one, if that's excused by many of you, because there is a passage that I often refer to at this time of year. It's a phrase that is oft repeated, and it's this: "Oh, give thanks to Jehovah, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever." And I went through and I pulled out several of the occurrences of this phrase: Psalm 106, verse 1, Psalm 107, verse 1, Psalm 136, verse 1, Ezra 3:11, 1 Chronicles 16:34, and 2 Chronicles 7:3 all have this phrase. And I think it's a wonderful phrase that I often associate with this particular holiday, and I encourage all of us, whether you celebrate it or not, to take some time over this long weekend. I hope many of you are off of work and spending time with family, and I hope that you take this time to reflect on the many things that we can be thankful for. So I know that my family is doing that. I have all of my kids and grandkids are in town this weekend. So I wanted to say at the outset that after the class, I'm not going to do a dialogue today because I'll be spending time with my family. As many of you know, my wife and youngest son generally are away working in California in the acting business. And so they're here, and so I want to spend some time with them. But happy Thanksgiving to everyone. We are in the midst of a study of the Joseph saga as we work through the triennial portions of the book of Bereishit, the book of beginnings, the book of Genesis. And we are right in the middle of what I would call high drama. These particular stories are gripping. In many ways, they should put the reader on the edge of the seat. Now, if you're not reading them like this, you're not capturing the full, whatever it is that the writer is trying to tell us. I want you to grab that, because these stories truly are some of the most interesting stories and some of the greatest tales that have ever been recorded. So I wanted to begin by saying this. I want you to understand this, that as we approach today's reading, the entire plan of God, if you will, hangs in the balance. The plan of God is hanging in the balance. If the brothers, that is the sons of Jacob, the sons of Israel, if they are not reconciled one to the other, the plan fails. It's that simple. There must be a reunion of the brothers in order for the plan, the continuity of the plan, to move forward. In other words, and I've sought to show this throughout this series that we've been working on, especially as we've entered into these patriarchal narratives, to show that as goes history, so goes prophecy. As the past, so the future. We've mentioned this several times. I've shown several examples. I am getting somewhat interpretive as I work through these passages, because whether or not one wants to believe that these stories in the historical narrative are intended to point toward the prophetic reconciliation of the sons of Jacob or not, whether or not that was the intended consequence of these texts, it does seem to provide uncanny similarities. The events of history often correlate with what the prophets say will happen in the future, and I'll continue to do that as we work through these narratives. So I want to say at the outset that what we have as we work through these stories, if understood properly, is somewhat of a picture, a bit of direction for us moving forward from the historical narrative to the prophetic redemptive scenario. Now, what I wanted to also say, I put in my notes that this is not some new commandment that I'm teaching you, but a very ancient truth. I think that the truth is evidenced by these texts. We are and we must be our brother's keeper. Almost immediately in the biblical story, if you'll recall, all the way back in the first chapters of Genesis. I want to begin in Genesis chapter 4 and go to verse 8. Actually, let's go with verse 9. Then Jehovah said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" And he said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" Now, what this particular text does for me as I set forward in today's class is it somewhat sets the stage for what appears to be a progressive separation between a paradise, if you will, where people are directly communing with their Creator, and what the biblical writer describes as a hopeless and lonely wandering. You'll recall from the early chapters the story of Cain and Abel, that Cain is described thereafter as, in Hebrew, a na-vanad, a fugitive and a wanderer, which leads to this idea of a hiding of the face. I just happened to see this morning that Dr. Tabor posted a snippet from a very old class that he taught some 20 years ago at one of the Athens B'nai Noah conferences called The Hidden Face of God. This story of Cain is the very first mention in the Hebrew Bible of the hiding of the face. Cain actually makes that statement that you've hidden your face from me. And from that point forward, throughout the biblical narrative, we get this progressive separation between God and the Creator, somewhat of a paradise lost, if you will. So, time and again throughout the narrative, what we get is that God seeks to establish His kingdom or His presence on earth, if you will, where His will is done on earth as it is in heaven. Story after story reveals failing after failing on the part of man, the true heart of man, or his actions apparently, are presented as contrary to the ideal. You know, if you look at the stories of Adam and Noah and the sons of Noah, down to Abraham. Now, what we've done over the past several weeks, beginning with the patriarchal narrative, starting with the patriarch Abraham, is we've sought to show that the Bible, as Tabor puts it, is the story of one man's family. It really does go from an overall human race, and the focus with Noah and the sons of Noah, down to this one singular figure initially named Abram. And from there, the plan is that it will be a one family show. I want to go to a passage in Genesis 18 as I set the stage for today's class. Remember, the point that I want to stress today is that the long-standing question, am I my brother's keeper? The answer to that question is yes. And in today's story, we're going to see how very true that becomes. So if you'll look in Genesis chapter 18, this is somewhat foundational of all biblical faith. And you'll see, beginning in verse 17, that Hashem, that the Lord, is asking a question inside Himself. He's walking, apparently, with Abram, and He says, "Should I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do?" This is in verse 17. "Seeing that Abraham shall become a great and a mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by him." This is a very universally applicable plan. It involves all nations, but it hinges on Abraham and his seed. Verse 19, no, for I have chosen him that he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of Jehovah by doing righteousness and justice, so that Jehovah may bring to Abraham what he has promised him. And what we get with the call of Abraham is the introduction of an idea, or an ideal, we might say, where God chooses the descendants of Abram, or Abraham as he's later known, to become what in Hebrew is called a goy gadol, a great nation. He chooses Abram to become the father of many nations, but within those many nations is going to be a model of excellence, if you will, a great nation who, through their obedience to this way of justice and righteousness, will ultimately bring blessings to the entire earth. Now, what we see in these stories throughout the patriarchal narrative is that familial strife in the family occurs over and over again. At times, the very plan is threatened because of this strife between members of the chosen family. The leading theme, and this is one of the points that I want you to get going into the class today, one of the leading themes of the Joseph saga is built around one significant question. And that is this: will the family, the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, learn to dwell together in unity, or will they not? It's very important. Now, last week, I began to share the central point in the story that I presented as a test for the brothers. There is a test that's ongoing, and the focus, important to the historical narrative as well as to the prophetic hope, is specifically whether or not the known descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob will be able to answer that ancient cry from heaven, "Where is your brother?" And that finally, realizing that in order to be the family known to Jehovah and a great nation, they truly must become their brother's keeper. Now, I want to remind you that in the book of Amos, in chapter 3, it says that you only, speaking of Israel, are the only family that God knows. The people of Israel, the only family of all the families of the earth that God has known or experienced in history, and there to be a great example. So I want to begin this morning by reading from the Transparent English Bible. So if you will open up, if you have that particular translation. If you don't, you can download it from our Facebook page. And if you don't have time to do that, you can follow along in a translation of your choosing, though this will be much more literal, as I've pointed out many times in the past. It begins, this particular reading set off by white spaces, begins in Genesis chapter 43 and verse 14. Genesis 43 and verse 14. For those who might be new to this teaching schedule, I'll just say as you turn there, that it's very important that we read the portion from the Torah, and then we talk about what this particular story is trying to tell us. This is a very ancient practice. It's mentioned in Ezra and Nehemiah chapter 8 in particular, where there was a reading from the Torah, and then the sense was made of it, the interpretation was given. So here we go. Genesis 43, beginning in verse 14, and it says the following: "And El Shaddai will give to you mercy before the face of the man, and he will send to you your other brother in Benjamin. As for me, if I'm bereaved, surely I will be bereaved. And the men took this present, and double silver they took in their hand, and Benjamin, and they rose and went down to Egypt and stood before the face of Joseph. And Joseph saw Benjamin with them and said to the one over his house, "Cause the men to come toward the house and slaughter a slaughtered thing and make firm, for the men will eat with me at noon." And the man did as Joseph had said, and the man caused the men to come toward the house of Joseph. And the men feared because they had been caused to come toward the house of Joseph, and they said, "Upon the matter of the returned silver, returned in our sacks at the beginning, we have been caused to come. For rolling himself upon us and throwing himself upon us and taking us for servants and with our donkeys." And they drew near toward the man who was over the house of Joseph and spoke toward him at the opening of the house and said, "Pardon me, my master. We really came down from the beginning to buy eatable things. And it was when we came toward the lodging place and opened our bags and look, the silver of a man was in the mouth of his bag. Our silver in its full weight, and we caused it to return in our hand. And we've caused to come down other silver in our hand to buy eatable things. We don't know who placed our silver there in our bags." And he said, "Peace to you, fear not. Your Elohim and the Elohim of your father has caused, has given to you treasure in your bags. Your silver came toward me." And he caused Simeon to come out toward them. And the man caused the men to come toward the house of Joseph and gave water, and they washed their feet, and he gave fodder for their donkeys, and they made firm the present until the coming of Joseph at noon, for they had heard that they were to eat bread. And Joseph came toward the house, and they caused to come to him the present that was in their hand toward the house, and bowed himself down to him toward the land. And he asked of them of peace, and he said, "The peace of your father, the old man of whom you've spoken, is he still alive?" And they said, "Peace is to your servant, to our father, he is still alive." And they bowed and bowed themselves down. And he lifted his eyes and saw Benjamin, his brother, the son of his mother, and said, "Is your brother, the small one of whom you've spoken to me?" And he said, "May Elohim favor you, my son." Joseph hurried out, for his insides were inflamed towards his brother, and he sought a place to weep, and he came toward the room and wept there. And he washed his face and went out, holding himself, and said, "Place bread." They placed for him, he alone, and for them, them alone, and the Egyptians who were eating with them, them alone, because the Egyptians were not able to eat bread with the Hebrews, for it is a detestable thing to the Egyptians. They set before his face the firstborn according to his firstborn right, and the little one according to his being little. And the men were amazed, a man toward his fellow. And he lifted things lifted from his face toward them, and he caused to be abundant the thing lifted to Benjamin. From the things lifted to them, five hands, and they drank, and they were drunk with him. And he charged the one over his house, saying, "Fill the bags of the men with eatable things, as much as they are able to lift, and place the silver of a man in the mouth of his bag, and my bowl, the silver bowl, place in the mouth of bag of the small one, and his silver for grain." And he did according to the spoken thing of Joseph that he had spoken. The morning was light, and the men had been sent away, they and their donkeys. They had gone out of the city. They were not causing distance. And Joseph said to the one over his house, "Rise, pursue after the men and overtake them, and say toward them, 'Why have you completed bad instead of good? Is not this that with which my master drinks and prognosticating, he surely prognosticates with it? You have caused bad in that which you did.' And he caused to reach them and spoke toward them these spoken things, and they said toward him, 'Why does my master speak according to these spoken things? Far be it from your servants to do according to this spoken thing. Look, the silver which we found in the mouth of our bags, we caused to return toward you from the land of Canaan. And how could we steal from the house of your master silver or gold? With whoever of your servants it is found, let him die. And also, we will be to my master for servants.' And he said, 'Now also, according to your spoken thing, thus it is. He with whom it is found will be to me a servant, and you will be clear.' And they hurried and caused to go down a man his bag toward the land. They opened a man his bag, and he searched With the large one he began, and with the small one he finished. And the cup was found in the bag of Benjamin. And they tore their outer garments, and a man loaded his donkey, and they returned toward the city. And Judah came and his brother toward the house of Joseph, and he was still there. They fell before his house toward the land. And Joseph said to them, "What is the doing that you have done? Do you not know that a man such as me prognosticating, he surely prognosticates?" And Judah said, "What can we say to my master? What can we speak? How can we justify ourselves? The Elohim has found the crookedness of your servants. Look, we are servants to my master, both we and he in whose cup hand the cup has been found." And he said, "Far be it from me to do this. The man in whose hand the cup has been found, he will be to me a servant. And you go up in peace toward your father." Again, very literal reading of the text. Most translations will smooth this out considerably. But I like the rhythm of the Hebrew in the Torah as it was written. And what we want to look at today is a deeper look at the characters involved in the story and how each of these characters represents part of the return and the reconciliation. So one of the things that we want to focus on is that the reading puts our attention, at least on the surface, on the youngest, what is called the little one in the Hebrew. He is a son of Jacob and Rachel, the youngest of the clan of Jacob, Benjamin by name. Now, you'll recall in the previous meeting of the brothers, which we covered in last week's portion, the brothers don't know with whom they are speaking. So they don't recognize him. Now, a big part of the reason of this is that, as we pointed out and as the narrative makes clear, Joseph looks like an Egyptian. He, in every way, looks different than his brothers. There is, in every meeting, an interpreter between them. So when Joseph speaks, you have to understand that it's not all going to be in the same language as it is in the Bible that we read. But he's going to speak in Egyptian through a translator to the brothers, and this process is reversed. When the brothers speak to Joseph, they speak in Hebrew, presumably. The interpreter will translate that into Egyptian to the Lord of the land, as he is often called. Now, the other thing that we get in the story is that from the earliest point, Joseph recognizes his brothers. So you have these two distinct stories going on. One, Joseph recognizes the brothers. He knows exactly who they are. He's learning things as they speak because they don't understand that he understands them. But it's interesting the way that the story unfolds. We learned last week in the reading that Joseph in many ways has moved on. You'll recall that he has two sons from this daughter of the priest of On, Asnat by name. The sons Manasseh and Ephraim indicate to the reader that he has moved on, that he's forgotten all the pain of his father's house, and he's become fruitful in Egypt. Now, the other thing that we see is that he recognizes that dreams that he had at a very early stage in the story have come to pass. In Genesis 37, he has these two dreams. He sees them being played out before his very eyes when the brothers come and bow down before him. And all of this story is prompted by famine. Now, the family begins in these stories to make a move towards a reconciliation, and these are the things that we want to focus in on. So, for instance, Benjamin is the key. In this particular Torah portion from the triennial cycle of readings, the story begins and ends with the focus being drawn towards Benjamin. In particular, when we talk about the test, which I mentioned last week and I'm going to focus a little bit closer on today, when we focus on the test is whether or not the brothers will learn how to treat a son of Rachel, whether or not they recognize that they truly must become their brother's keeper. Now, from birth, Benjamin is presented in such a way, using his name as a clue, to two possible outcomes. Remember, when he's born, he's given a name other than Benjamin by his mother. In fact, let's go to that passage in Genesis chapter 35. Genesis chapter 35, and I want to begin in verse 16. All right, Genesis 35, verse 16. It says, "Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when they were still some distance from Ephrat, Rachel travailed, and she had hard labor. When she was in her hard labor, the midwife said to her, 'Fear not, for now you will have another son.' And as her soul was departing, for she died, she called his name Ben-Oni. But his father called his name Benjamin. So Rachel died, and she was buried on the way to Ephrat, that is, Beit Lechem." This is a very interesting story. Remember, Rachel was, she had a difficult time bringing forth. For many years, she was barren. And when God opened her womb the first time, she had Joseph. And then she brings forth again a son who will be instrumental in gathering the other brothers. Now, there is a prophetic text that I want to look at this morning because I see some similar themes. Now, what I'll say at the outset is that I'm not suggesting that this particular prophetic passage is speaking absolutely about the story we just read in Genesis. But I will say that it's got some similarities too much to ignore. So if you will go with me to the book of Micah, Micah chapter 5. Micah chapter 5. Now, this is typically not the understanding of this text, but I think it's very interesting. Micah chapter 5, beginning in verse 2, because there is some correlation here that I want to lead into. Remember, the point is that Benjamin, a son of Joseph, will be used to bring about the assembly of the brothers. Micah 5:2, "But you, Beit Lechem Ephratah, who are little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose origin is from of old, from ancient days. Therefore he shall give them up until the time when she who is in travail has brought forth. Then the rest of his brethren shall return to the people of Israel." And it goes on. So what is the connection between Genesis 35 and Micah chapter 5? Here's what I see. Again, the themes, the words seem to connect in some strange way, almost as if one points to the other. What we have is the story of one who is in travail, one who not only brings forth, but who brings forth again and ultimately brings about a reunion of the brothers. Now, there's also mention of Beit Lechem Ephrat. In the story in Genesis 35, Rachel, who becomes a prophetic figure, we'll look at this in a moment, Rachel brings forth and then brings forth again. Now, this is the point that I want to make. She does this at Beit Lechem towards Ephrat, which in Hebrew is Ephratah. And what we get in Micah chapter 5, Micah chapter 5 is dealing with a family, not with a location. Many people look at Micah chapter 5 as predicting a birthplace of this coming ruler. But generally, if you read it literally, what you see is that it's not dealing with a place, it's dealing with a clan. Notice it says that in verse 2. Of course, in the Hebrew, it's verse 1, but if you're looking in an English Bible, but you, O Beit Lechem, towards Ephrat, all right, or Ephratah. Now, if you look at 1 Chronicles and you follow through these genealogies, what you'll see is that these names occur very specific to a family line associated with Judah. But I just wanted to make this point that those words and phrases are connecting these two, at least in my mind. Some of you might want to pray for me for that. But anyway, now, the other thing that I want to look at is Jeremiah chapter 31. What I want you to see is that Rachel's seed is very important when we're talking about the restoration. Go with me to Jeremiah 31, and I just want to pick up a couple of passages. If you go to verse 15, this, by the way, is set off by white spaces. It says, thus says Jehovah, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are not. Now, the Hebrew says, because he is not. So this idea is that the prophet sees great lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is crying because her son is not. Now, you recall from the story thus far in the Joseph saga, at every place along the way where the brothers describe Joseph, how do they describe him? He is not. Time and again we see this. The brothers will make it very clear. We are all the sons of one father. One is with our father, one is not. See? So Joseph, in the narrative, is spoken of as being not or not being. Now, look at verse 16, Jeremiah 31. Thus says Jehovah, keep your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for your work shall be rewarded, says Jehovah. They shall come back from the land of the enemy. There is hope for your future, says Jehovah. Your children shall come back to their own country. Now, the promise, now, so if people are a little hesitant to connect the historical narrative with the prophetic, the way I'm interpreting these things, this is why I want to show you these prophetic texts. Because whether intended or not, the prophets pick up on the stories and they use these to speak about the descendants of the characters in the historical narrative, if that makes sense. Now, throughout our narrative today, there are interesting hints and allusions that hint at the Rachel story that we read just moments ago and that we've been following over the last several weeks. Let me give you an example. Do you remember when Rachel and Leah and the children and Jacob flee from Laban in Genesis 31. Rachel brings with her something that belonged to the father. She brought idols. And we talked about this when we went through that particular Torah reading. Now, Laban sets out to overtake them, and one of his primary objectives is to retrieve his idols. He complains about how Jacob took him in the middle of the night and he didn't get to kiss the grandbabies goodbye, but he keeps talking about the idols. He really wants the idols back. He might want his family back too, but he really wants his gods. In fact, in chapter 31, verse 28, there's this phrase where he tells Jacob, "You've done foolishly." Now, once again, Rachel's descendants are associated with objects of worship foreign in nature. I want you to get this, because I think it's a theme that shows up both in the historical narrative as well as the prophetic text that we're going to be talking about. What do I mean by that? I want you to get that Rachel and her descendants are generally associated with idolatry and false worship. This is one picture we get of Rachel's kids. Now, in the story today, Joseph has a goblet or a bowl, depending on how you translate the Hebrew there. And he uses this for prognosticating. It has to do with divining. Now, there are various historical stories out there, and we know a little bit about this, but it has something to do with liquid being in this particular bowl or this goblet or whatever it is, and they would look over the water and make predictions and so forth. What Joseph does is he places this divining object, this object used for foreign worship of some way, and he puts it in. He could have put it in any bag, but he puts it in Benjamin's bag. So we have Rachel stealing her father's idols. We have Joseph using this bowl or some sort of container to tell the future, if you will. And he puts it in Benjamin's bag, another son of Rachel, by the way. And so it reminds me, in the book of Hosea, which is written to the northern kingdom, descendants of Rachel, Ephraimites, and it says this in Hosea chapter 4, verse 17, "Ephraim is wedded to idols." Now, I know that there's a big movement right now where people are feeling that they might in fact be the lost sheep of the house of Israel. They're calling themselves Ephraimites and so forth and so on. And you know what most of them have had to come to grips with? That at some point in their religious past, they were somewhat wedded to idols. So I think that this is an interesting correlation. But remember that, Hosea chapter 4, verse 17. Ephraim is wedded to idols. "Leave them alone," it says. I think that there's coming a time, and I think that we're witnessing this in our day, many people are turning from various forms of idolatry, which has held them back for many, many years. This is an age-old problem with Ephraim. Remember, when the kingdom divides in 1 Kings, the very first thing that they do under Jeroboam is set up two idolatrous centers, one at Dan and one at Bethel. And ever since that time, Ephraim has been wedded to idols. Now, sounding a little bit like Laban, Jacob will say in this particular story, "You have wrought ill." Now remember, Laban says, "You've acted foolishly." So the correlation between the story sort of grips me as I work through. In Genesis chapter 31, for instance, Jacob declared that the one with the idol, what did he say? "Whoever you find the idol with, that person should die." Now, Rachel, at the time, the idol wasn't discovered because she lies to her father. She hides the idol. But what absolutely occurs very soon afterwards in the narrative is that she does die prematurely. Now, in our story today, go with me to Genesis chapter 44, verse 9. Genesis chapter 44, verse 9. All right. This is what the brothers say. With whomever of your servants it be found, meaning the divining object of Joseph, let him die, and we also will be my Lord's slaves. Now, they're just sure that they didn't take this, right? I mean, they make a big point. They said, Why would you think we took this thing from your place? Someone put money in our sacks. We're honest men. I mean, we brought money back, and that ought to prove our honesty. So why would we steal your object, your divining object? So they're really stressing that. But what happens as they begin to open the bags is it is truly discovered. Now, here's a point that I wanted to make. These stories, both in the story in Genesis 31 and in our story today, what they do, in my mind, is represent distortions, if you will, of true service to Jehovah. In other words, the involvement of idolatry and false worship. I tend to read these stories about the sons of Rachel, and I'm beginning to pick up this recurring theme that the Bible is trying to tell us. You're going to find Ephraim and Joseph and Benjamin, and there's going to be some way to connect an idol with the story. Now, here's a thought that I had as I worked through this. Rather than offering up the offending one to death, like Jacob does. You know, if you find that idol in any of my stuff, whoever's got it can die. Or the other brothers, they say, whoever you find your cup with, let them die, and we'll be your slaves. See, they go extreme with it. Here's a better alternative, perhaps, for the descendants of Joseph, those who feel they might be descendants of Joseph today. How about serving properly? That is, how about eliminating the idols and promise to be a servant? Now, here's what I mean by that. Go with me to Genesis 43, 18. In Genesis 43, 18. I'm going to show you what happens to the other sons of Joseph, or of Jacob, as our story progresses. In verse 18 of 43, the men were afraid because they were brought to Joseph's house. And they said, it's because of the money which was replaced in our sacks the first time that were brought in, so that he may seek occasion against us and fall upon us to make us slaves and seize our donkeys. Now, what's their main concern about being brought to Joseph's house? They feel like that this is going to lead to them being slaves. Now, but by the end of it, by the end of today's story, when it really gets dire, when the situation becomes very grave, they are willing at all cost, rather than make another blunder, to give themselves up to be servants to the man. Now, behind the scene, or rather just below the surface in our story, is an expressed desire to know the Father. I'm getting interpretive here, but I want to show you something. Look at Genesis chapter 43, verse 7. And I have to go through this interpretive mode with you, because next week, beginning next week, we really get into some interesting correlation. Genesis 43, verse 7 says, they replied, Now, this is when the boys go back to Jacob and they're telling him about their meeting with Joseph that they don't know is Joseph yet. They replied, "The man questioned us carefully about ourselves and our kindred, saying, 'Is your father still alive? Have you another brother?'" So remember, he's basically asked them, "Why did you even mention that you had a brother?" And the brothers are telling the father, this man expressed interest in you and whether or not you were alive. Now look at chapter 43, verse 27. 43, verse 27. Now this is when they meet with him this time. This is one of the first things he says. Watch Joseph. "And he inquired about their welfare and said, 'Is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke? Is he still alive?' And they said, 'Your servant, our father, is well. He is still alive.'" Now, I think this is important because when we get into the next portion, we're going to see that the word father is used 14 times. The focus is going to shift. Right now, to bring about the reunion, the focus is on Benjamin, a son of Rachel. But we're going to notice this. So I want you to begin to think about how Joseph is primarily being driven to bring about the restoration because of his love for the father. And I would say this. I believe it's the same way today. I think that Joseph, that the descendants of Joseph, whoever they might be, wherever they might be, one of the things that's driving Joseph in our day, if I may, and what the prophets seem to indicate, is a love and a desire to know the Father. Despite Joseph and Ephraim and the house of Joseph and the house of Israel, however you want to describe them throughout the prophets, despite their association with idols and paganism and false worship and foreign ways, being separated from family and from the Father, the thing that pulls Joseph out is a desire to return to the Father's house. That's what's driving a great reunion today. Now, the brothers return in our narrative. When the brothers return, I want you to begin, look at chapter 43, verse 14. This is where our reading begins today. I'm picking up on themes. I want to begin with the prayer, if you will, that Joseph offers up. I mean that Jacob offers up. He says, "May God Almighty grant you mercy before the man, that he may send back your other brother in Benjamin. If I'm bereaved of my children, I am bereaved." And notice, there are a couple of things that stand out. Jacob appeals to El Shaddai, the God who he will refer to many times later on when he's giving the blessing over the sons of Joseph. He also talks about how El Shaddai has guided him all the days of his life. So he refers to El Shaddai and that El Shaddai would grant chesed as the brothers return. Now notice something about where he says that he may send back your other brother in Benjamin. You notice that? He doesn't even mention him by name. Now, what is it about this brother? And we talked a little bit about this last week, so I won't go through it. You have to go back and listen to that class. Simeon, I'll touch on it. Simeon has done some very cruel things. Simeon and Levi, and Jacob can't even stand Simeon and Levi. So much so that in Deuteronomy 33, Simeon isn't even mentioned in the blessing. So it's interesting when you look at this, Simeon is not named, but Benjamin is. Now, Jacob does believe that all the brothers should be together, but he just simply refers to him in passing as your other brother. Now, one of the other things that stands out to me in this particular text is that there's a mystery man. Look at, let's see, verse 16. And I want to read once again, verse 16 through 25, just to give you this idea that I want to make this point. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, we don't know who this steward is, bring the men into the house and slaughter an animal and make ready, for the men are to dine with me at noon. The man did as Joseph bade and brought the men to Joseph's house. And the men were afraid because they were brought to Joseph's house. And they said, it's because of the money which was replaced in our sacks the first time that were brought in, so that he may seek occasion against us, fall upon us, make us slaves, and seize our donkeys. So they went up to the steward of Joseph's house and spake with him at the door of the house, and said, oh, my Lord, we came down the first time to buy food. When we came to the lodging place, we opened our sacks. There was every man's money in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight. So we brought it again with us. And we brought other money down in our hand to buy food. We don't know who put our money in our sacks. Now, this is the point. This is what the servant says. He replied, rest assured, don't be afraid. Your God, the God of your father, must have put treasure in your sacks for you. I received your money. And then he brought Simeon out to him. The point I want to make is that this particular statement by this unnamed man gives credit. Now, he's working closely with Joseph, gives credit to the process about the restoration being divinely guided. He says, God did this. All right. Now, we know from reading the story that it's being orchestrated by Joseph in particular, but it's all about bringing the family together. Then they have the meal. There's weeping. Joseph is very emotional. Four times in the narrative, Joseph weeps. And in this particular story, it says that when he is overtaken with emotion, he has to step out of the room, weep, get composure again, and then come back into the room. But he is on the edge. He wants to reveal himself to his brothers, but he can't do it because it's not yet time. Why is that? Because the brothers have not proven themselves in the test that Joseph has set before them. Now, the men are amazed because Joseph is giving clues all along. He sits them in birth order. Now, how would he know that? This week, when we got everyone together for Thanksgiving, I took a picture of my four sons together. And obviously, my youngest son, you can tell the difference. But my other boys, you know, I don't know that someone who doesn't know their ages could discern who is the oldest to the youngest. But imagine, as the story presents it, all the way from Reuven all the way down to Benjamin, the boys are set in order. And it says they were astonished. You know, like you could imagine, they're like, wow, how does he know this? Look with me at chapter 43. Let me see something. Verse 27. Now, I read this a moment ago, but I want to draw something else out. In the English, he says, and he acquired about their welfare and said, is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke? The point that I want to draw out of the text here is that there is a conversation about the peace. How, it doesn't say welfare, it's how is the peace? Now, this indicates that they've come a long way in this restoration, because if you go back to Genesis 37, verse 4, notice this. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. A conversation of peace can't even take place until later in the story. It has to be at the right time. Now, one of the things that I'd like to pull out now is, if you look at the silver, I notice Friedman pointed this out in his commentary on the Torah. The first trip that the boys make, there are 9 sacks. Remember, Simeon is detained, and 9 of the brothers have silver put back in their sacks. The second trip, Simeon is released from jail, and 11 sacks are filled with silver. If you add the two together, we have 20 collections of silver. Now, what Friedman points out, and I think it's interesting, that if you go back to Genesis 37:28, Joseph is sold for 20 pieces of silver, and it's almost like this test is now giving indications of what the crime must, the punishment has to fit the crime. So we were sold for 20 pieces of silver, now 20 bags of silver. It's almost like an indicator that someone knows about that former incident. All right, now, go to chapter 44. Chapter 44 of Genesis, verse 12. And he searched, beginning with the eldest and ending with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they rent their clothes, and every man loaded his donkey, and they returned to the city. I want you to just think for a moment about what's going on in this story. Remember how difficult it was to convince Jacob to let them bring Benjamin to Egypt, and how Judah had placed his own life on the line, basically, on behalf of Rachel's youngest son, knowing full well what the father had gone through. And as I pointed out last week, Judah was the only one of the brothers, as far as we know, who could relate to the father's losing the son. Just as Jacob had lost Joseph, seemingly, and he watched, Judah had watched his father go through that, we see in the story in Genesis 38 that Judah, too, not only lost one son, but lost 2 sons. So he understood. But imagine, if you will, if you were watching this in a film and the bags are being opened and they check Reuben's bag. No, it's not there. It's not there. And you get all the way down, and Benjamin, in his bag, they find Joseph's cup. Now I want you to look at verse 16, because I want you to hear Judah as he steps up and makes this declaration. And Judah said, "What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? How can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and he also, in whose hand the cup has been found." Now, remember, what Joseph has said is that, we're going to read this in a moment, that's not justice. We found the cup in this one person's bag. That's who gets to stay. But if you'll go back when the brothers first came before and they're brought into Joseph's presence, they were concerned because they didn't want to become slaves. But here, Judah is willing to become a servant. He speaks on behalf of the whole people. He says, "Look, we're willing to all be servants." Now look at what Joseph says, verse 17. But he said, "Far be it from me that I should do so. Only the man in whose hand the cup was found shall be my slave. But as for you, go up in peace to your father." And our story today ends with that particular word from Joseph. He says, I'm not going to keep you all. It's the one who had my cup will be my slave, and the rest of you go back to your father. So we're left with this idea. The brothers have something to decide. Now, Benjamin has been used in a test. Joseph has used Benjamin all along to see if the sons of Joseph, the sons of Israel, are willing to save themselves at the expense of one of their own. Now, before, when we first meet with the brothers and Joseph, in the very early, in Genesis 37, they hated Joseph. They couldn't speak peaceably to him. They were willing to kill him in order to be free of this son of Rachel that was such a problem for him. Now they've learned some things. Life has a way of teaching lessons. At this point, they have in their care another son of Rachel. And the whole test is whether or not they're willing to sacrifice one to save themselves. Joseph remains outwardly separated from his brothers. Last week's reading, it says that he made himself a stranger to them. There's no way they know it's him. And over, he's providing clues, dropping little hints, if you will, at least the narrator is in our story, but the brothers don't pick up on it yet. Joseph keeps his emotions private. The brothers show signs of remorse. They truly have begun to demonstrate a true repentant behavior. Do you see it in the text? You see the difference? They have an excuse. If they were to go back to Jacob and leave Benjamin in jail or as a servant to Joseph, to the man of the land, the lord of the land, what would they tell their dad? They'd say, look, he stole the man's cup. They found it in his bag. Now, whether or not Jacob would believe it or not, but they had an excuse. They could have left him. But here's what the story wants us to get. They're unwilling. It's not an option for them to save themselves any longer at the expense of a brother. Famine has forced the beginning stages of the reunion. Peace now becomes a question, part of the dialogue where that was previously not an option. The lessons have been learned. Sons of Israel have learned that they are their brother's keeper. If only they could answer this question, which we'll get to next week. Where is Joseph, your brother? And that's the way we'll leave it today. Question becomes, not only in the historical narrative, where is Joseph, your brother? But the greatest question in all the prophets comes down to this same question. Where is Joseph, your brother? Shabbat Shalom.